You refer to an emerging discipline called planetary health in an article you recently co-authored. Planetary health, what is this exactly?
Look, it's a discipline and a way of thinking that's evolved to address our growing understanding that human health and the health and well-being of the whole planet is linked. And if you can think about it, we've understood that our health is related to our healthy environments for a long time. But increasingly, we've got our thinking around the Earth system and what that means for the planet, particularly in climate systems, the biosphere, but also pollutants, the movement of nutrients, fresh water. It affects the functioning of the planet, and that affects our local environment, and that local environment affects our health wherever we are. And so it's become really quite important to be able to combine those spheres of thinking. And some of your listeners might be aware of, say, the Eat Lancet Planetary Health Diet that got some coverage last year. And that's an example of understanding what those multiple areas are that need to be thought about. So, say, human health, population growth, environmental sustainability. What do you do to get a diet that is healthy, is not going to cause harm to the environment, so we can keep going with such a diet, and we can ensure that we can feed what's predicted to be 10 billion people shortly? And won't surprise your listeners that that emphasises reduced meat and dairy and increased vegetable intake. But that's the sort of thinking, that multidisciplinary thinking that's behind planetary health.
On the surface of it, it makes sense to us to say, well, look, if we're breathing in a few less fumes, we're obviously going to be a bit healthier. If we're not swimming in polluted waters, that's obviously a good thing. But how do we link it through to something like COVID-19, the COVID-19 pandemic, which you've described as a wake-up call?
Well, COVID-19 is not the first of a series of pandemics that have arisen from wildlife viruses, all right? And it's not only just a human, wildlife-to-human transfer of these viruses we've seen recently. We've also seen wildlife-to-livestock-to-human transfer of viruses. And this is a relatively new phenomenon, and we've particularly seen it since the 1970s. And that sort of time period is significant because our colleagues in the WWF will tell you that we've reduced the population of wild animals in that period from the 70s through to, say, recent times by about 50%. You know, our onslaught on biodiversity is extraordinary. But in terms of viruses, this means that we're pushing humans into wildlife habitat. We've got wildlife seeking refuge in human habitat. And with our growing numbers of people, we've got more people seeking bush food, or more people as part of the trade in poached wildlife, and wildlife ending up in markets for restaurants. So there's just more of this interaction happening, and viruses do what viruses do. They take advantage of these opportunities, and as a consequence, a number of new viruses have emerged. Ebola, SARS, our original SARS coronavirus. And we've seen these sorts of things happen in Australia too with Hendra virus. So we've got multiple examples of these things. But you talk about biodiversity onslaught, environmental onslaught, climate onslaught, and they are related, but not in exactly the same way. But once you start to join the dots, we're telling quite a big story here. So in terms of climate, you need to recognise that climate is shifting where animals, wild animals, can live. They're changing their distribution. Viruses are often transmitted by insects and parasites. They're also changing their life cycles, distributions. We're seeing this with malaria and dengue, for example. In the expression of a disease like COVID, which is a respiratory disease, we're seeing an impact, or we're seeing an increased risk or a vulnerability in populations, because We know that air pollution, for example, one of the biggest consequences of burning coal, and that being one of the biggest drivers of our greenhouse gas problems, are causing respiratory disease at an extraordinary scale around the planet. WHO estimates that 9 out of 10 people on the planet don't actually breathe healthy air. But air pollution drives about a third of our respiratory problems, lung cancers, cardiovascular disease. And we might have thought of that just as a overseas problem, something that you might see in big mega cities. But after this summer, where almost half of Australians were exposed to air pollution from our bushfires, I think we have to recognise that this is becoming much more of a problem in our own backyard, and with its link to climate change, something that we really have to think differently about.
As you say, with those bushfires, it was quite a wake-up call into the kind of air pollutants that result from those tremendous fires that we saw. In terms of solutions, I mean, once upon a time, if we're talking biodiversity, we're talking saving the environment, it was obviously, well, we save the environment for its own sake because we want an environment. Now, if we're getting selfish, if we say, well, saving the environment is also saving ourselves, what kind of solutions do you think we should be looking at?
Look, I think we've got a lot of evidence that points the direction we should go. And one of the problems that I think people often grapple with, it seems so complex, it seems so overwhelming. Do you do this? Do you do that? What do you prioritise? But we're actually in a situation at the moment where global thinking has moved a long way in this direction. And I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, but I'll pick them up here because they're an example of 17 priorities. And the authors of these tell you that they struggle with whether they should have more or less, but 17, what they ended up with 169 targets. So these are multiple goals around climate action, ending poverty, zero hunger, good health and well-being for all at all ages, sustainable cities, peace and gender equality, life on land, life on water, and so on. But within that is the thinking that you actually need to achieve these 17 goals at the same time. And the reason I raise this is because 190-odd countries, including Australia, are signatories to supporting and promoting the Sustainable Development Goals, which means it's a common language internationally that sets out a framework about how you might, or we should, progress these multiple agendas at the same time. And in the background of that is this vision that you can have, if we put our minds to it, a future that's not only environmentally sustainable, but it's equitable across all nations, between all people, and desirable. It'll look good. It'll be really rich and rewarding. And I think it's really important that we keep that sort of vision and that sort of breadth of framework front and centre in our thinking.
Well, it is. Look, it's a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Raj. Really do appreciate your time joining us, having a chat with us about this one this morning.
Thank you very much, Sean.